Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
And there's quite a bit of mystery surrounding the dismissal or the supposed illness of Vice Marshal Ri Yong-ho, who is pretty much the mentor of the young leader in North Korea. I take it that the illness is a cover story, that he was essentially purged.
Yes, that is correct. And this removal of Ri Yong-ho is quite significant. I think a lot of North Korea experts suspected this, even by April, when Yi was not awarded any promotions at the party's conference. So some experts, North Korea experts, thought that was a sign that Yi Hong-ho's future was already in doubt back in April. He was a powerful figure, Yi Hong-ho, as you said, who was a very close friend of his Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. And he was a powerful figure who helped with the succession transition for Kim Jong-un. He, along with two other people, Kim Kyung-hee, his aunt, and his uncle-in-law, Jang Sung-taek, he was only one out of the three guys who really helped Kim Jong-un transition, succession transition. So this is quite significant, and I see it as a purge.
So you mentioned April was his last appearance, and he didn't get I think it might have been his last appearance, but he didn't get the promotion expected. Would that have had something to do with the failed missile launch or the satellite launch?
I am not sure that if that it's connected to that. I don't know. And you know, who really knows why he was removed? But we know that it's definitely not because he was ill. First of all, he had no signs of illness that we know about. And besides, even when all the North Korean officials are usually in poor health, they usually stay in their post. This is unusual. We do not know what the reason was behind his removal, what the disagreement was, why he was removed. It's probably Kim Jong-un's attempt to sort of strengthen his hold on the military and the regime, and maybe as a warning to the military and the party officials and anyone who could potentially represent a potential threat to his authority, that, you know, is to show that someone like him, Ri Yong-ho, can be removed as, again, childhood friend of Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un's own mentor, that what does it mean for others? So I think it's a warning, but we don't know what's behind the disagreement that led to this.
So, Sumi Terry, on the other side, if you will, the civilian side of things, as opposed to the military side, and there's no question that from the very beginning, Kim Jong-un reiterated the Songun military first policy. But a lot of Korean watchers are quite fascinated by the mysterious woman that's shown up at his side on state television at a music concert and visiting a kindergarten. That's not keeping with tradition, I take it, in terms of the previous, the father and the grandfather. The women were pretty invisible in those days, weren't they?
No, that is true. And it does seem like Kim Jong-un has a different leadership style. He's clearly more comfortable, you know, in his own skin than his father was. He gives public speeches and so on. I don't know. Maybe North Korea has hired some sort of a consulting or PR firm that we do not know about. There's definitely interesting PR blitz coming out of the country. It seems like all the imageries and pictures and all his speeches are just, it is very different. In terms of women, it probably reflects just his, you know, his generation. He's only 28, possibly 29 years old. And, you know, who wants to see these ladies all covered up, right? So, yeah, so on this concert, apparently there are various women wearing shorter skirts and sleeveless dresses, which is a big no-no in North Korea.
Well, that fashion statement combined with the appearance of Mickey Mouse at this concert with these young women in miniskirts playing violins, etc., has certainly gotten people all worked up. But isn't it a bit of an irony that Mickey Mouse, obviously the Walt Disney Company, you're not getting any royalties there. Wasn't that the reason why, in many ways, why Kim Jong-un ended up being the successor? The other brother who was expected to be the successor, didn't he get arrested sneaking into Japan to visit Disneyland, right?
That is really, I am quite fascinated by Kim family's fascination with Disney. Yes, it is absolutely true that Kim Jong-un's oldest son, got into big trouble after he tried to sneak into Japan with his family, with his girlfriend or mistress or wife, with a couple kids, and he tried to visit Tokyo Disneyland using fake passport from either Dominican Republic or some other Latin American country. And that effectively ended his chances of succeeding Kim Jong-il, because until then, which was, I think that was 2001, until then, he was in line to succeed Kim Jong-il. But after that fiasco, Kim Jong-il reportedly got very upset, and that just effectively ended his chances.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So there's something a little surreal about our conversation so far, but that's the nature of this regime. What I find, I don't know whether you've ever seen the way the people on South Park, the comedy routine, deal with them, but in many ways I think there's probably some of the most accurate portrayals of this strange family. But what I find fascinating about the way that Western analysts deal with North Korea, with the exception of a few, that they talk about it as this communist, Stalinist state in all of those kind of Cold War terms. And my understanding is, particularly from scholars like Brian Myers, that we've got it wrong, that this is not a left-wing government as such. Their ideology is not so much important as the dynastic hold that this family has. And the only way to understand that is to understand Imperial Japan. And that's the better analogy, that this young boy emperor that's running North Korea now and asserting himself is rather in the tradition, more in the tradition of a right-wing Japanese pre-war emperor than a communist leader. What's your...
No, that is absolutely correct. And it's not only Imperial Japan, but Imperial Korea, Imperial Joseon Dynasty. This is truly... And also Kim Il-sungism, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-ilism, which is sort of unique system that they have going. But I absolutely agree with that. It's not really... You shouldn't really look at North Korea from a communist lens per se. It's truly a unique country. This is the only country that has third hereditary succession. The only two other leaders that North Koreans have known are Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un, this 28, 29-year-old boy, a boy king, who has not served a day in the military, and has, you know, is a four-star general and so on. So I think that is a correct way of looking at it. It is truly a unique place, that's quite hard to understand.
Well, one of the things that the North Korean media are saying now, and I wonder if there's any truth to it, you know, in deifying these leaders, they build statues all over the place. And then at the time when the missile launch back in April failed, they unveiled two huge statues of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. And apparently they also have carved a massive 400-foot-long wide swath across a natural rock face to mark Kim Jong-il's birthday back in February. And apparently throughout the country, they've carved these messages in adoration to the dynasty on cliff faces, etc., in this kind of form of what nationally sanctioned graffiti, I guess. It's a strange thing. But what the North Korean media are now reporting is that the South Koreans have sent agents in to deface some of these statues. Is there any truth to that?
I don't think it's South Korean agents. North Koreans have been facing with its own, the public. There's a little bit more awareness in North Korea as information is at least slowly slipping in. And I believe it's probably their own disgruntled, some of disgruntled North Koreans versus South Korean agents. But of course, this is how North Korean media would spin it.
So that means then that people inside that regime don't buy this cradle-to-grave Juche philosophy and incredible propaganda and incredible worship of the leader, the dear leader, the great leader.
Well,
and now
great majority of people do, but that's not complete, and there is a chip in that that pillar of the information control and then ideological indoctrination. There are cracks to that where now information is going through from China to North Korea, and more public is aware that this more, not all, but still more than before, people are aware that this this indoctrination and this what they're hearing from the regime is not the 100% truth. And they are now more listening to South Korean pop songs, music, shows, the videos, soap operas, movies. They come in through the defectors and through the border from China, and more people are aware of this. And this may be a sign where Kim Jong-un himself, he decided to watch all these Disney characters, he sort of switch to change because he is very much aware of the public mindset that it is changing. And there have been signs in the past before where there are people who did, make graffitis on the Korean won or have a little bit here and there. And of course, if you get caught, you'll be sent to a political prison camp and be in massive trouble. But there are more people who are aware, and we have been seeing signs of discontent, at least still a small level. It's not going to be like Arab Spring type of thing. But still, there's more information coming in now.
So I think, wouldn't it therefore be reasonable to conclude, Sumi Terry, that there has been some incidents, some statues have been defaced, and that the way that the North Koreans are spinning it is that they've had to acknowledge it, and therefore the propaganda machine is blaming it on the South. Otherwise, why mention it?
Exactly. No, that's exactly what they're doing. Is they have to talk about it because it is happening, and of course, the easiest people to blame are South Koreans.
So
instead of admitting it's their own people, of course.
Right. So, Sumi Terry, explain to me, though, why there's enormous sympathy in South Korea for the North, and a lot of people in the South, and when I've interviewed people that have been critical, like Brian Myers, who've been critical of the North at the time of the sinking of the warship and the shelling of the island, etc., I get angry mail from people who think we're all being told lies and that North Korea is not as bad as it's portrayed. And apparently that is fairly pervasive in the South. And so what explains it? I mean, I think the shelling of the island, I think, woke up a lot of people in South Korea, but I recall at the time of the sinking of the warship, there's still an awful lot of people in South Korea who believed the North Korean version of it and that felt that it was just South Korean propaganda.
Yes, first of all, it's quite complicated, but yes, with the sinking of the Cheonan ship, believe it or not, 50% of the Korean people still are not sure, and they believe that their own government came up with made up the evidence or so on, which is really hard to believe, as you said. But shelling of the Yeonpyeong Island really was a game changer in that they were, as the shelling unfolded in front of them and they were watching it on television, there was no denying the North Koreans were doing this. So that did have an effect on South Korean public's mind. So now going forward, I believe that if North Koreans really push it, if there's another incident such as that, I think South Korean public will be less willing to, support North Korean cause or be more willing to be a little bit more hardline. So that Yeompyeong Island incident was a game changer in that. But to answer your question, that really has to do with a lot of factors. But first of all, there was a whole decade of sunshine policy in South Korea, where the government leadership was much more sympathetic to the North Korean regime, and that went on for 10 years. And during that 10 years period of time, there was a sort of a shift in mindset in the public's mind. And also, you have to remember that North Koreans and South Koreans are, they come from the same people. My own family, my entire paternal side came from North Korea. So my grandfather, grandmother, and my aunts and uncles, and they all came from North Korea. And these are really same people with the same language, same culture, same heritage, same. So it's, they have tendency to sympathize with the North Korean people and the suffering of the North Korean people.
Well, but why? There's one thing to have sympathy for the suffering of the North Korean people, but it's another thing to believe to disbelieve the aggressive nature of the Korean regime. It has a million, one of the biggest armies in the world, and we know that a lot of the food aid goes to a country that can't feed its own people because of its totally screwed-up policies.
It's always been the case. That's why I really point to the whole 10 years of the sunshine policy under Kim Dae-jung and Noh Myon presidents. Before that, if you remember, during the Park Chung-hee era of 1961 to 1979, North Koreans were considered evil and hard and so on. There was their own South Korean indoctrination and in the education system in terms of portraying North Korea as the evil country. And that went on from Park Chung-hee regime presidency to Chun Doo-hwan presidency and so on. But so it was really a decade of during the Sunshine Policy, where South Korea was exercising Sunshine Policy, that there was a shift in Korean people's thinking.
So in other words, what's happened here is that the early South Korean governments, the military governments, were
much more hardline, yes.
And their propaganda was so crude that it led to the deep sort of skepticism that the public has towards the government. And you're saying that that's changed somewhat, though, since the shelling of the island.
Yes, since the shelling of the island, there was just no denying it. Just that whole thing unfolded as they were all watching, South Korean public was, they were fixated on television. They were all watching on television as their island was getting shelled and their citizens got killed. And that really, did put damper on things. And now I don't think Korean public would be as easily, would just say, okay, at next provocation, we should just, let them just continually act this way. I think South Koreans would be more inclined to now say we have to react and stop such provocation.
So do you think that we'll be having a similar conversation again in a year or 6 months? Over the years, I've talked to Korean experts, and you always end up saying, will there be change? And sometimes people say, well, yes, maybe, maybe not.
There's not going to be much of a change. This whole cycle has been going on for a very long time, and I'm afraid that it's going to continue. I'm not quite surprised by almost anything. Even when you think about provocation, we tend to think our North Korea's provocation has been sort of extreme in the recent years and so on with nuclear tests and missile tests. But you have to remember that North Korea's provocation was a lot worse way back when. North Koreans have completely, remember the terrorist attack against the South Korean airliner. North Koreans blew up a South Korean airliner, killing hundreds of people. North Korea, with a bomb in Myanmar where it blew up half of the South Korean cabinet. I mean, North Koreans are used to conducting this kind of acts for decades and having gotten away with it. South Korean government did not react to, North Koreans tried to assassinate South Korean President Park Chung-hee and ended up killing his wife, First Lady. And, my point is you have to put their escalations and their provocative actions in historical context. And they've been doing this for a very long time, and they have always gotten away with it, and I don't see why they would change now. And I certainly don't think that it would change just even under Kim Jong-un. And I would warn people from reading too much into these recent gestures and symbols, Disney characters, into thinking that somehow North Korea will suddenly liberalize or abandon its nuclear weapons or, you know, ready to join the international community. I hate to be a pessimist, but I don't see much changing in the next, in any time near future.
Well, just in closing, Sumi Terry, what about the cracks in the regime? You mentioned videotapes. My understanding is that South Korean soap operas are very popular in North Korea. They bootleg them, and so much so that the North Korean security people keep turning off the power, although they have regular power outages at any rate, and they go to homes and the videotapes get jammed in the in the players. That's one of the techniques they use to. And you know that there's a lot of smuggling going on the Chinese border. A lot of people are sneaking out. More people are sneaking out. It does seem that at least there are some cracks there. And if there are some people inside the country that haven't been brainwashed to the extent that they're defacing monuments of the dynasty. Are these just anecdotal?
They are anecdotal, but, you're absolutely correct. And, I say there are roughly four pillars to regime stability, how regime remains stable despite of everything that's going on. And they are, from foreign assistance to pervasive security apparatus to ideological indoctrination and monopoly on information. These are pillars of stability. And there are cracks to all the pillars of stability. Right now, in terms of foreign aid, the South Korean government has not been giving any kind of foreign aid. There is the security service is not as effective as before because now there's a lot of corruption and you can pay off these or bribe these security guards so defectors can, defect from North Korea. Ideological indoctrination is not as strong as before or pervasive as before. And certainly on monopoly on information, as you said, there are definite cracks as these unwanted information is coming into North Korea through China's North Korea border. Movies, DVDs, and CDs, they're all getting smuggled in. And as you said, North Koreans are huddled together, and watching these movies illegally and listening to radio stations and so on. But that said, I don't think even this is enough to see any kind of, there will be any kind of a public uprising as some might expect, as something like Arab Spring. I still think if there's going to be any kind of instability in North Korea, it's going to come from top, it'll be top down versus bottom up. It will have to come from the elites.
Well, I think
potential factional struggle, because elites are the ones that's keeping the system going. It's the elite support for the regime that makes that aids the stability of the country. You have to remember during the famine years in mid-1990s when millions of people died because of famine. North Korean government did not care about that. It really doesn't matter what the public is going to do or not do. If there's going to be any kind of real trouble with the North Korean system, it has to come from the elites. Disgruntled discontent from the elites, I mean.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sumi Terry.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University and the managing director at Gerson Global Advisors. Previously, she was a national intelligence fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former deputy national intelligence officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs on the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.